Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what the fuckadelics, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. You know, it's been a heavy time. It's been a heavy few weeks for me personally in terms of dealing with my folks and dealing with my own insanity around where I'm at in my mind, in my body, at my age, in my heart. It's been a rough few weeks. Not as rough as they could be, obviously. I have a broken foot. But not just, you know, life is difficult sometimes for any number of reasons, real or imagined. But yesterday was a difficult day. Richard Lewis passed away. The great comedian Richard Lewis. And he's been on this show. He was on this show back in 2011. That was episode 193. It was a long time ago. It was in the first couple of years of the show. I remember it. I remember him coming over. I remember reading I'm Dying Up Here about the Comedy Store. I was very nervous because Richard Lewis was one of my heroes. Richard Lewis was one of the guys that when I was starting out at some point earlier in my career, I was compared to. Not because I was as good as Richard Lewis, but we sort of treaded in the same territory of introspection, neurotic observation, darkness. And I never thought I would meet Richard Lewis. I never thought I would spend time with Richard Lewis. And then he was coming over to my house, and it was still early enough in the show where, to this day, I'm like this. I was experiencing a lot of nervousness, and man, did we hit it off. And it's interesting because a lot of times he's definitely on my list of all-time favorite comedians, but somehow or another, through most of my life, I felt like a kindred spirit. Like, I knew he was a comic, but I felt that we were on the same spectrum, whatever that is, addicts, Jews, neurotic obsessives. I just felt like he was a mentor before I knew him, some sort of kindred spirit. And it's interesting because after I talked to him that first time, I was kind of lit up, and I felt like I never know when or how or if it's possible to be friends with somebody, a guest that I talk with on the show, because I always put them at another level than me. A lot of them, some of them are not. But over time, you know, I started hearing from Richard. He would email me, you know, mostly about what he was doing, articles about him, things that he was excited about. I didn't think that the emails were specifically to me, but there was something about Richard where there was this idea that, you know, like, I'm alive, this is what I'm doing. But it became more personal, and I became a little closer to him. I wouldn't say we were close friends, but we were in a sort of cosmic way. And I have a lot of those kind of relationships where, you know, I talk to somebody and I just know that, like, he gets it. He gets me. I get him. But it got sort of surprising. And I think the thing about Richard Lewis is that his love for Lenny Bruce and his love for the craft of comedy in an old school way, and in a specific way, in a stand-up comic way, not in a comedian way, not in a entertainer way necessarily, but in stand-up comedy, his interest and his love for stand-up comedy as an art form and as a way of expressing himself in a very specific form, which was stream of consciousness, which was, you know, taking risks. You know, a lot of people may not have seen Richard as he got older, but, you know, he was out there. I mean, he was out there in his 60s. He died. He was 76, I believe. It was very public that he was struggling with Parkinson's. Apparently, he died of a heart attack. But he was out there. I mean, he was out there with his stack of notes riffing. You know, he really sort of is a legacy of a type of comedy that is very specific. It's Lenny comedy. Nobody really does it. Not many people. I think there's at least two or three generations that know the name Lenny Bruce, but don't understand the drive shaft of Lenny Bruce, the way where you get into a groove, you lock onto a riff, and you just go out there and you see where it goes. Not everybody does that. Very few people do that. And Richard was that was the way he did it. That was the template. Obviously, him and Lenny are different in terms of the way they did it, but that was the mode. There's very few people that riff. You know, doing stand-up, you're doing crowd work. Some people call that riffing. But going up there with an idea and just opening it up, it's not for everybody. It's a very unique and ballsy way to do comedy. And Richard was out there just engaging in the craft nonstop until he had to slow down. And I always respected that. And I'll be honest with you, you know, when I was younger and I was watching David Letterman, and I talked to Richard about this, I had the pleasure of doing his short-lived podcast, and I don't mean that as a joke, Alive and Unwell, and that's ironic now as well. But he asked me to be on it, and we talked in a very sort of candid way about each other and about ourselves. And I was able to tell him to his face on his show, you know, how I felt about him and how he was an inspiration to me before I was a comic, as a young guy, as a kid. I would watch him on David Letterman, sit down, and just open up that fucking valve, man, and go, you know, just go. And he had this manic pace. He was fidgety. He was always moving. You know, his hair always looked good, always dressed in black. And he would just go. And I would watch him talk to Letterman. And I wanted to do that. Like, I wanted to do comedy, but I wanted to sit down and go. And that was really the main driver for me, you know, asking Conan O'Brien if I could be that guy for him. And he let me. He let me. I was a panel guest, you know, long before I deserved it, long before anybody knew me. And I was able to sort of honor that thing that Richard did. And as a comic, I always had Richard in mind in terms of, you know, what you could do if you choose your speed and you have the fucking balls to just go. And it doesn't happen all the time with me, and I'm sure it didn't with him. After a certain point, you get riffs that stick, and you repeat them, you add to them. But that was the style I did. It was Richard's style. It was Lenny's style. But it wasn't improvising like a Robin Williams thing. This was stream of consciousness. It's a type of improv, but it's really a heady thing, and you know it becomes performance. But it wasn't about characters and jumping around. It was about just riding the lightning of being on a riff that's working. And Richard was great at it. He was also, you know, a sober friend. I'd done the A-List years and years ago. He was hosting, and I remember he wasn't sober yet. And I remember it was sort of this known thing that, you know, I want to talk to Richard. But, you know, he was, you know, in the dressing room, he's drinking. He was a different guy. He was a different guy. And I got to just tell you, you know, every time, what a sweetheart and a supportive guy, despite the fact that he was very self-involved. He was just a very sweet guy, and he made you feel better, and if you related to him, you felt seen. But our relationship, again, you know, I can't claim him as a close personal friend, but every time I got an email from him, I was just, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that Richard Lewis was sending me an email. He asked me to be on his show, and I did it. And then on my birthday, when I turned 60, he texted me, "All the best, buddy. You're an amazing, authentic cat. I love you, sober brother artist, Uncle Richard." I used to call him Uncle Richard, and he took to it. He was very kind to shoot me an email telling me how much he liked my special and how much it reminded him of himself at a different time. And, you know, I don't know. It's a rough time, you know. It's a rough time, I guess always. But I am 60, and I'm seeing more people that I love pass, more people that I respect pass, more people that I'm close to, including my parents, struggling. And it's just life. But still, every time it happens, you know, it's jarring and surprising because, you know, Richard was really too young. You know, our friend Bob Saget was way too young. And these last two guys, you know, Bob, I still can't. And again, I wasn't that close with Bob, but I loved him and we knew each other. I would say we were friends, but not close friends. But his passing devastated me. And Richard's passing is devastating. You know, I knew he was sick and it was a difficult illness. I hesitate to say it, but it was a gift that he was able to go out quickly like this in light of that illness. But I'm going to miss knowing he's around. I'm going to miss, you know, getting these, you know, kind of erratic dispatches from him. I'm going to miss the fact that, you know, I felt like our friendship in terms of really connecting was a young friendship in a lot of ways. And when I did his show, I told him, I said, you know, you can still get out there and, you know, and be funny even in the face of this illness. And I offered to moderate some shows for him if he just wanted to sit down and kind of riff with me. But he was not, you know, he just didn't feel comfortable. You know, he had a very hard time accepting the illness and what it was doing to his body. And it's a hard thing. It's a very hard thing. And it's just, it's profoundly sad. He was really a one-of-a-kind person and a one-of-a-kind performer in a tradition, a very specific tradition of stand-up comedy, of what it meant to be a stand-up comic. And I differentiate between stand-ups and comedians sometimes. But Richard was a true stand-up, and I loved him, and I'm going to miss him. And I hope he rests in peace. But I feel like that's highly unlikely. So that original show that I did with Richard was episode 193. We did that in 2011, July 18th, to be exact. It was a big day for me. A great conversation with Richard. It's currently behind the paywall, so we took it out and put it up in the regular feed today for people to enjoy and remember Richard Lewis. If you want to spend time doing that, it's a great conversation. Today on the show, I talked to Mae Martin, and they're great. I watched their Netflix special, as well as the series that they're in, Feel Good, some of it. May is a Canadian, but spent a lot of time doing comedy in England. May is also a recurring role on the HBO series The Flight Attendant. They're a very interesting act, and I didn't know much about them. And I knew that we had, you know, we were always missing each other at Largo. They would do a show, and I'd do the next night, and I'd heard about them, and I didn't, I didn't really know what they were up to, and I knew they'd been around for a long time. But, you know, I watched May's special, and I was like, oh, my God, I have to talk to this person. And it turns out, you know, throughout the conversation that, you know, we had more in common than I anticipated. So that's that was exciting. It's exciting when you meet somebody and you can't see that there would be necessarily common ground other than we are stand-ups. But it was surprising, and it was a great conversation. Tonight, I'm at the Elysian here in Los Angeles. The next week, I'm in Portland, Maine at the State Theater on Thursday, March 7th. Medford, Massachusetts at the Chevalier Theater on Friday, March 8th. Providence, Rhode Island at the Strand Theater on Saturday, March 9th. Tarrytown, New York at the Tarrytown Music Hall on Sunday, March 10th. Later in March, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia at the Buckhead Theater on Friday the 22nd. Boise, Idaho, I'm at the Egyptian Theater on Saturday, March 23rd as part of Comedy Fort at the Treefort Music Fest. Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater on Wednesday, April 3rd. Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Turner Hall Ballroom on Thursday, April 4th. Chicago at the Vic Theater on Friday, April 5th. Minneapolis at the Pantages Theater on Saturday, April 6th. Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. Okay, look. I really enjoyed this conversation with Mae Martin. I think it's a real talk. They definitely have a way of talking that feels like it's totally put together. But that's just the way of talking, because like I found out like, oh, we share a lot of issues. So you can watch their specials, Dope, and the most recent one, Sap, on Netflix. The series Feel Good, which May co-created, is also on Netflix. You can also hear May co-host the podcast Handsome and the Audible series Benefits with Friends. This is me talking to May Martin. Good to finally meet you.
Good to meet. Well, we met once, right? Actually.
When where?
Vancouver.
Okay.
I was like 20.
Really?
Yeah, and I was...
I can't remember. Were you dressed differently?
Oh, I'm sure. I think...
Did you wear glasses?
I had tits, first of all.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, probably very skinny jeans.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was with like Dave Foley, and doing a show. I was.
Is it the fest?
It was a festival, and it was... But it was...
Was Tig there?
Yes, I met Tig. That was the first time I met Tig, too. I met both of you, and both of you were pretty aloof. I mean, I was like, who was I?
She's always aloof, though, and until you get to know her, then you realize that's just the way she is.
Yeah, you're like, oh, she doesn't hate me.
That was the period where, for some reason, we always found ourselves dressed similarly.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So we were pleasant, me and Tig, or I was, at least?
Yeah, you were pleasant enough. I think I was just in way over my head with... I think I only had, like, 10 minutes of material at that point, and I was just booked... to do some televised show with John Doerr and
How's that guy doing?
Great, so funny.
So you didn't grow up in Canada, or you did?
I grew up in Canada, then when I was like 21, I moved to England for 13 years.
But what's the background? Because I watched the special and I watched some of the series, because I always knew about you, and we were always at Largo almost like alternatingly.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm like, well, what is she doing?
Yeah.
So now I'm kind of up to speed, but it sounds like you had a pretty good childhood.
Yeah. Yeah, it was all right. Yeah, I did have a good childhood, I think.
Because
I was like,
the story unfolded in the special. I'm like, wow, well, things got dicey.
Things got dark. Yeah, yeah.
But what part of Canada?
I grew up in Toronto. Yeah.
And that's then a good city, right?
Oh, man, it's the best. It's like a dirtier, cheaper New York.
I mean, less dirty.
Oh, I don't know. Of course. It's more run down, though. Like, there's like a kind of earthiness that New York doesn't have.
Sure. Like. For years I'd go to Canada and I'd be like, it seems like kind of like America, but there's no fear in the air.
Yeah.
And it's a little slower.
Yeah.
And people ride their bikes at night everywhere.
My parents still don't lock their door or
right.
anything. Yeah,
and there's no guns.
I know.
But for years, I was sort of bored by it. But like when Trump was in office, I'd go up there and be like, I'd get off a plane and be like, it's not here.
Yeah.
Whatever it's down there, it's not here.
That tension, that like oppressive tension.
Which is with everyone. It infuses everybody.
Uh-huh.
But it never felt that in Canada. And because of that, I applied for a permanent residency.
You did?
I did.
Yeah.
I'm panicky.
I had a few people try to marry me after the pandemic, like just for the passport and...
They're onto that, though. Aren't the Canadian governments? They make sure it's legit.
Yeah.
But so you were just in the city?
Yeah, I was right in the city. And then, but my dad's British. And so we would go there a lot.
Dad's British?
Yeah, he's super British.
Like, so now do you have both passports?
I have both passports. So that's why I moved to England in my 20s. And
Because you just could.
Because I could. And everyone else was moving to the States, like other comics. And
who'd you start with?
In Canada?
Yeah. Like, who came down here that I would know?
Nathan Fielder was in Toronto at the same time as
He's Canadian?
Yeah, he was doing sketch and stand-up.
But no stand-up? He did stand-up?
He did stand-up, but he was hilarious.
I don't know what's up with that guy.
Yeah. you got to get him on here, because I'd like to...
I believe we tried.
Oh, really?
And I think he manages whatever that thing he is pretty well.
Yes.
I don't get the sense that he wants to go too deep into Nathan Fielder.
No, he wants to curate it a bit.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Maintain the socially awkward, neurotic mystique.
Yeah.
But what kind of stuff was that guy doing as sketch? Was it this similar to what he does now? Was he ever normally at all?
No, never normal, no. But always, always. He was one of those guys who, like in a smaller circuit like Toronto, one guy starts blowing up and then everyone starts doing what they're doing. So everyone sort of started becoming Nathan Fielder. And,
oh, God.
Yeah.
That's an incredible aspiration.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't think that he would have one of those personalities that was contagious.
Yeah. Well, everybody started getting a little surreal and kind of anti-comedy. There's still great comics up there. But then, Sabrina Jalisse moved down here.
Yeah.
And then, I was like, I'll never go to L.A. It's so fake and shallow. And then I got here and was like, I don't know what that says about me. I love it.
Well, it's just a city. I mean,
it's
like,
just a city. It's not at all fake. Yeah.
The conception is that show business people are just like robots walking around Los Angeles.
I know.
They have no sense of the sprawling nothingness of this city.
Exactly. And the nature. And
yeah.
And
you
also
do have access.
Maybe because there's more opportunity, there is less competitiveness. Like, people are actually more genuine because there's more of a sense of like there's room for all of us. And there's,
well, that's interesting.
I think so. Like in Toronto, definitely it can get a little cutthroat.
Well, yeah, because there's like one TV network.
Yeah. And there's like, you know, a handful of clubs. Like,
right. But it seems, I've always thought that if you live and work in Canada, that eventually you'll get your shot.
Do you think?
Yeah, maybe once.
I don't know. I know.
Is that not true?
I know people who are so good, like just better, just amazing comics, and they're just, the infrastructure hasn't been there for them
They're just doing Breslin clubs.
Yeah, just sort of headlining and but now it's changing because of streamers and stuff. Like people are, they're doing more productions there.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah.
You mean American productions or CBC stuff?
Like they opened a Netflix Canada that
they're
putting a lot of energy into, and Amazon and things like that.
Oh,
so,
they're there.
Yeah, so they're there.
Where are they, in Vancouver or Toronto?
Toronto, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I like Toronto because like I was doing some serious thinking about like if I actually, see, I apply for permanent residency, which is sort of like a green card.
Yeah.
Which you have to spend 2 out of every 5 years up there to get the health care and to work. So that's the deal.
In a chunk or?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
All right.
Yeah. But like, but I thought like, even if I don't use it, it's bought me, you know, a few years of peace of mind.
Yeah. Yeah. The healthcare thing is huge.
Is it all right?
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
So, all right, so you're growing up in Toronto. It's not rural. It sounded like it was rural where you grew up.
No, it's like city.
Just city.
Yeah.
And what's your dad do?
He's a writer, so.
Like a successful one?
He was growing up, he was a food critic. And so that was sick because we would get to go to restaurants.
Yeah.
But it was the 90s, so it was a lot of like, I feel like sun-dried tomatoes were big and like Alfredo sauce, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Trends.
And then
I never liked sun-dried tomatoes.
No.
I never liked them.
Me neither.
Yeah. And then what happened?
Then, I started taking improv classes at Second City when I was like 13. That's what I got obsessed.
So were you like notorious for being like the youngest Second City person kind of thing?
Yeah, I got all that like all that
attention.
Yeah, which is so seductive at that age and addictive.
What made you do it? Like, who were you watching that made you want to do it?
Well,
it's kind of a, I mean, I loved comedy when I was like 11 and 12, but
same, yeah.
But I was watching old guys. Who were you watching?
Old guys too. Like my parents are comedy fans.
And oh, really?
So I had like my mom was into American, you know, Steve Martin albums. We listened to like Vinyl, Steve Martin and Richard Pryor and George Carlin. And she took me to see Seinfeld, I think, on stage when I was young. And George Carlin, she took me to see. And Kids in the Hall. That was massive for me.
Yeah,
Canadian.
Sure.
Like, and they were like rock stars. Like everyone was shouting out the punchlines to their sketches. And I was just like, what is happening? And they're like in drag. And
this is when you were a kid.
Yeah, like 11 or something.
And they were doing live shows. But it was, the series had been on already, right?
This is like a reunion tour.
Okay.
Yeah. And then my dad was into British comedy and like Python. And
any of the stand-ups?
Less so. Like, all the British comedy I've loved is kind of sketch, like French and Saunders and The Young Ones. And
yeah, no,
like,
Stuart Lee?
No, that was sort of after his time.
Oh,
so
okay.
I, when I moved to England, I was like, everyone was like, he's the comedian's comedian.
Right.
And but by the, when I saw him, I mean, I get it now.
Right.
But moving to England, having not grown up with him, and then the show I went to see him do, he was just... I think making fun of another comic for like an hour, like that. But I didn't know the comic. I was like, "What
was it?
Going
was
on?
It the Franklin Ajay record? Was he, or was it an English comic or an American?
It was an English comic. It was just like a new material night, and he was just ripping into this comic who I didn't know. So it all felt very inside, and everyone was like, "Yeah." But now I understand the genius.
Yeah. I had always heard about him, and then I saw him once in Edinburgh, and I got it. He's got like his own time zone, you know, his own thing, his own pace.
Exactly,
and it's smart.
Very smart.
Yeah, and it's nuanced. I learned something from him, though.
Yeah.
Because he quit for a while, you know, because he couldn't take it. He couldn't take performing for audiences that were dumb or didn't get him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think he just hit the wall. And he stopped for a while, and then what brought him back was him realizing that it's not on him. Like, if, you know, he found empathy for the people that were in the audience that didn't get it. Because they just made the wrong choice.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I thought, and that helped me look at things.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't, you know, it didn't make me think everyone's a fucking idiot.
I've just never had that. Maybe I've got too much self-loathing to, like, be mad at an audience really ever. It's always going to go back. I'm always like, I'm just not doing my job right.
Oh, really?
Like, I mean, occasionally you're like, especially if you're touring big clubs and there's like, bachelor parties and shit.
That's
I would get outraged for sure.
Yeah.
But in general, I wish I had more of that. Like, I feel that, like, I'm desperately trying to get.
Oh, yeah. No matter what.
Approval. Yeah.
I don't know. I know when I'm doing a good job, and I know when an audience is flat. And the last time I did a club run, there was a bachelorette party.
Oh, really?
And I know now I draw my people. So it's a fluke.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know who would. They can go online now and just see who they're going to see.
Yeah.
So I'm like, why are they here? And I told them, I said, it's not going to be a great night for you. And and I'm not really the guy. And you still have enough of a night left if you go now.
You said this before.
No, I said it on stage.
Oh, this is great. Yeah.
And they left.
They did?
They did.
Oh, nice. Well, to be honest, good for them for being like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, if this is your, I don't know why they come to comedy clubs. I still can't understand why it's some sort of institution that bachelorette parties come. Because I think they just expect us
just to
shit on
them. To riff with them all night.
Yeah.
It's a really like outdated perception of what
it's
comedy is.
It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
So wait, so you're at Second City and you're just doing sketch?
Yeah, I was doing improv and sketch. And then
13.
When I was 13, and then I dropped out of school when I was 15 to do stand-up and do it full-time. Because really quickly, because there was like, I guess, buzz around being so young, even though I was objectively bad.
At improv?
At everything. I just like,
you were a kid.
Yeah, I was a kid. I was desperate to do it though. But then, so I was doing like 4 or 5 nights a week and I was just really tired in school. So
did they have you play the kid all the time?
Yeah, well, it was just me and my friends. So I would mainly play adults, mainly play my teachers and things like that.
But at Second City, when you were taking classes and stuff?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I guess I was often the kid. Yeah. In my school uniform sometimes. Yeah.
You had a school uniform?
I did. I went to like a private school till I was like 13 and then.
Like a Catholic school?
It was an Anglican school.
Anglican.
Yeah.
What's the angle on that?
The angle is, you know.
How is it different? It's an Anglican Church of England? Is that what it is?
It's pretty mellow. Yeah. All I remember is we had a carpeted gymnasium, which it was like they were so convinced that we wouldn't do any sports.
Yeah.
That we had a lot of rug burns and stuff.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and we had to say good morning to Jesus sort of vaguely.
But there was no guilt, no plaid skirts, none of that kind of
like
business?
Like tunics. Yeah.
Tunics.
It was one of the most unattractive uniforms you could ever imagine.
Was that the intent, do you think?
Yes, I think it was. I think it was to totally desexualize like
everybody.
Well,
that's good.
Yeah.
I think children should be desexualized.
Yeah.
If possible.
Agreed. Yeah.
And it was all girls?
It was all girls, and I didn't feel like a girl, so I had like all through. Well, in elementary school, it was good because I was like, I felt like the only boy in the class, and people were really into it.
Yeah.
And I would do like Backstreet Boys dances, and people would be like, "Yeah, this guy's cool." And then puberty hit, and everybody like, I just felt like an alien. Like they all had the bright stationery and lip gloss, and like it's like they were born just knowing how to be
a girl.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, "Oh, what?" And
so when you started to feel that way, you were how old? Like that you were just not fitting?
Well, I always felt like, I remember even being like 5 years old and looking in the mirror and being like actively being like, I'm not like fucked up about it.
Yeah.
So always. But
fucked
then,
up about it.
Yeah.
Like
just being like
a mild confusion.
Yes. Like quite an acute, like.
Right.
I'd be like, yeah.
What
yeah.
happened?
What is going on? Yeah, yeah. And I always had short hair, and my parents let me dress however I wanted to dress or whatever. But
they were pretty progressive?
They were about some things, yeah.
No religion in the house, really?
No, they were like staunch atheists.
So they just sent you to the Anglican school because it was a good school?
Yeah,
That kind of thing. What'd your mom do?
She never really did. She worked. She sort of ran our lives and then briefly
How
worked.
How many siblings?
Just me and my brother.
Oh.
And then they had another
Older?
Child who died right before I was born.
Oh,
there was
Jesus.
A third one. So
how old did he die at?
He was 2 and a half.
Oh, my God.
I know. Can you imagine?
No.
Anything worse? Yeah. And then, but I have an older brother, 4 years older.
What, was he sick?
Yeah, he had leukemia.
Oh, my God. That's so heavy.
I know. Sorry.
No. I don't mind. But like, so you kind of, like, there was an awareness of that, I guess, once you got to a certain age. Were there pictures around and stuff?
It's weird, you know? I never talk about it because it feels like their tragedy.
Sure.
And so I've always felt like, but it definitely was omnipresent, like in the house.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there weren't really many pictures. I think they were doing what they could to just kind of get by compartmentalizing. And now they talk about him a lot more, but I definitely felt, I knew that there something mega had happened before, and I definitely felt like this
the weight
of it. Yeah. It was like the telltale heart, you know,
in the
house under the floorboards.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I think about it a lot.
They talk about it now.
You know, not much. I think at a certain point you're like.
But they've integrated it.
Yes, like they have pictures of him up, and they
sure.
You know, my dad actually wrote a book. When in his 40s, about where he talked about it,
a memoir kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's so heavy because, you know, I've talked to people about this kind of thing before, and you know, people that go on to have other kids, there's just this that weight of grief is always there.
I know, and people are like, "What? You know, why'd you do comedy?" And I think I definitely remember one conversation where someone said to me, like in an offhanded way, like. Oh, and you were sent to cheer us up after this terrible tragedy, you know? And it was just, you say something like that in a poetic way, but when you're like 4, you're like, all right, that's my job. Like,
right.
Let's do this.
So when you start, you know, sort of feeling, what word would you say? Awkward?
Yeah, sure.
But you never got any, I guess the gift is that you did not get any resistance from your family.
Yes. Yeah. I think like I had a core kind of armor from my parents being, like my dad used to be an actor in musical theater and stuff. So they always had gay friends and stuff like that. And in the 90s, you didn't know any trans people, but I definitely knew that I was all right to be myself.
Right.
And then, yeah, in my teens I started, but I was always really attracted to men. So in my teens I dated men and
yeah.
and girls and
yeah.
But it took me until my 30s to sort of
lock in.
To lock in, yeah. Yeah, now I'm locked in, man. Yeah.
Well, I guess there wasn't, like, I mean, all this stuff is, because I'm probably as old as your dad. How old is he?
66.
Oh, no, I'm 60. So this whole spectrum of gender stuff is relatively new to me, even.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I certainly, you know, have, you know, I knew plenty of gay people and plenty of, not, I didn't, but, you know, trans, it didn't, it was not a category.
I know, like, I remember, what's that, Chaz Bono. Like, that
yeah,
was,
sure.
like, truly in the 90s, I was, that's all I had heard of.
Were you like, it's possible?
No, I was, I didn't even know till my 30s, I was, like, so unhappy. I just thought I was, yeah, it was so crazy.
But so I think, that's how it sort of manifests. It's like a unhappiness, but it, you know what? But what is the feeling? Like you are alien within yourself?
Yeah, it was kind of like, it's like, well, when I was like 31 or 30, I was like, I thought about having top surgery like every day.
Yeah.
For 15 years,
and yeah.
I it kind of didn't occur to me that like everyone didn't think about that.
Right. Right.
I was like, oh, and it was kind of like when, and then I started using they pronouns and just feel and
yeah.
and now I'm on like a low dose of testosterone, and as soon as I had that surgery it was like there'd been like a fan in the room going
yeah.
that I didn't realize
yeah.
that someone just turned off the fan, and it was like, oh my god, my whole life this annoying fan has been on, like or I've,
yeah
yeah, but so it's been cool.
And what is the effect of the testosterone?
I don't, it's like I'm not sure because it's so incremental
yeah.
but it's like my voice has changed slightly and my weight distribution. It's all just like trying to feel
wild,
a little bit more like myself.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Like, yeah. But it's wild. Cause it is, it does feel like such a new phenomenon, but it's of course so ancient. And like, as
I know you talk about that in the special that there, that, you know, I don't know that I've heard it explained like that, that there is a spectrum of gender that's always existed.
Yeah.
It just now it's gotten a little more specific.
Yeah, I'm still also, anytime I'm like talking about it, I'm
yeah.
so afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing and alienate my own community because I don't know. I didn't go to high
Tricky.
School. Like, I don't know anything. But being put in a position where I'm talking about it a lot, I have met interesting experts and stuff who I'm learning a lot about, like science and like biology
yeah.
and how there's such a spectrum in everything. And this whole idea that everything is binary.
Yeah.
Is like a recent colonial idea.
Not, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And that's a scientific study and not a psychological or cultural study. I guess it's a mixture.
It's both. And
yeah.
so I always thought like, oh yeah, gender's sort of cultural and
yeah.
and then of course there's biology, and I think that's true. But then also if you dig deeper, the more you dig, the
yeah.
more there's really no absolutes, and in all across nature there's variations in like biological
right.
gender as well.
Right.
I don't know. Whatever.
Well, no, but that, well, that was, yeah, I mean, you don't have to totally educate me. I can go do the reading, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, but the idea that like, you know, sex, you know, procreative sex is like specific in a certain way.
Yeah.
But that's just a narrow zone
yeah.
of defining sexuality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
I didn't realize, you know, men can lactate and breastfeed. Like,
really?
Yeah. Like, seriously, if you had a baby...
Do you just have to focus really hard?
Literally, you just get the baby on your nipple and you can lactate because your hormones change. Your body knows what to do.
Oh, because of the baby.
Yes. And
yeah.
so you can lactate almost enough to feed a baby and keep it alive.
That's crazy.
That's so fucked, right?
No, I guess it's kind of interesting.
It's cool.
I guess it takes a certain type of dude.
Yeah, to be like, you know what? I'm going to breastfeed
yeah,
this baby.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'll do
yeah,
it. Yeah.
yeah.
So... When, so you drop out of high school, but at that time you're just kind of, you just feel a certain way, but you're just dating whoever.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
it's never really been a massive part. Like,
yeah.
I only have had to talk about and think about identity because of what I do now,
yeah.
now as an adult and stuff. But in my teens and stuff, I was just,
Just doing comedy?
Yeah, just living my life. Yeah. Just doing drugs, just really.
Yeah, I mean, that was surprising to me. Like, you know, when you brought that up in the special, I was like, really?
This is the big thing we have in common. Like, this is, I've always felt a kind of,
yeah,
like, I've been so grateful for the way you talk about addiction.
Yeah.
And like, it's, yeah, because I think we have a similar kind of.
Well, it sounds like at least you like the same drugs as me.
Yes, insatiably, yeah.
But it was sort of surprising because, you know, the way you talk about your family and outside of whatever struggles you had within yourself around sexuality or gender, it seemed like you had a lot of good support and pretty open-minded parents, which I guess I did too, because I think there's some part of me that wants to blame the upbringing for something.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the only thing you can really blame is that there's some sort of legacy. There's a, you know, a generational something.
For sure.
That makes us compulsive drug addict people.
Yeah, there's something that, creates a dearth or something that when you have the drug, you're it's assuaged in a way that for other people it's not.
Yeah,
and I guess is that.
Well, then, but I don't know how you are with it, but like, you know, the idea of self-medicating, I get that.
Yeah.
But if I'm sort of adverse to regular medication.
Right. Really?
I am.
Okay.
And it's not great.
Yeah.
Because the anxiety levels and the levels of dread and then, you know, figuring out, you know, manageable things I can be compulsive with that won't destroy my life. Like, I don't know why I'm stubborn about, like, I don't want to be on anti-anxiety or antidepressant.
I'm trying to get off them. I'm on just like an antidepressant.
Yeah.
And it's, I went on it, I guess, at some point.
Yeah, to feel,
you know,
sure.
And now I've been on it for so long. And I'm
right.
And then
you're curious?
Yeah, I'm curious. And then, but they're always like, well, if it's working, don't mess with it.
Right.
Like, I guess.
Oh, no. So
you're
kind of like, you know, you want to pull the stop out?
Yeah. I'm curious, but then I don't know.
You know, go spiraling down.
Yeah.
So when did you start using drugs?
Sort of as soon as I think even as a kid, I remember being like a hedonist. Like I wanted more of everything.
Well, I also was, all my heroes were like drug addicts.
Of course. Yeah.
Right?
I definitely romanticized.
And when I saw people smoking, I'm like, I'm going to do that.
Yes. My parents smoked in the house. So that,
oh my God.
Yeah. I would.
Did you smoke?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I still struggle with I have one cigarette a day now.
I got off nicotine for a month, but now I'm back on the pouches a little bit.
Oh.
I'm trying to.
Oh, yeah.
I was on lozenges. Nicotine's been the bane of my existence
really?
Forever. The most I ever had off it was 3 years.
Oh, man.
And I felt pretty good, I think.
I quit in my 20s. I quit. And then in the pandemic, I started having just one a day. And I know that can't be a physical addiction. It's like habitual, but I can't seem to stop.
You just have one?
One cigarette every night. I look forward to it all day.
Yeah,
I think Sarah Silverman's the same, but I'm like, I got to stop. What am I doing?
Well, because eventually you'll be like, oh, it's two. It's two in the afternoon.
I'm just realizing I'm lying a bit. It's often two. It's often one at lunch.
Yeah?
I got to stop.
Because it creeps back. It's so bad.
But yeah, so then when I was 13, I became like a big stoner, pothead. And then, but then I was hanging out with adults. So at Second City at the time, there were.
Really? They were just turning the kid on?
Yeah, there was a lot of coke around. And then, but I think I might have been the one bringing the coke in, I don't know.
As a 14-year-old?
Yeah, or 15. I started dating a much older guy, and he got me into it. And
That guy.
There's always that guy. Yeah. So that was that. And then I really loved it. And
the coke.
Yes.
What about the booze?
Never had a problem, really, with booze. That's
never balanced the coke with the booze? Just straight up coke?
For sure. But I've never, if I'm drunk, I never want to drink the next day kind of thing.
No, yeah. No, but
it's always been stimulants.
But didn't you have to, balance it with booze?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right, so you're 15, you're dating an older guy who turns you on to blow. You're bringing it to Second City.
Yeah, none of my friends were really doing it. And then I when he broke up with me, I found coke elsewhere.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah,
and was like, well, still got this.
And this is in Canada.
This is in Canada, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And so when does it be, what kind of jokes are you doing? Are you doing sketch? What are you doing?
Around then I was doing, the most self-indulgent stand-up. All my fun sketch friends were like, you're weird. And then I was smoking cigarettes on stage and trying to be like Mitch Hedberg, and that is so not who I am. And I'm so glad that there weren't smartphones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I talk to, like, I see these new comics, like, putting up everything they do in their first year, and I'm like, what are you doing? That's not going to go away.
I know.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Insane.
So when do you get your first, opportunity that you, in terms of knowing you're on the right path?
I think.
Outside of the attention of being a younger person, did you do Just for Laughs as a kid?
I didn't do Just for Laughs, but I definitely... it was kind of tricky because in my early teens, I got like Canadian Comedy Award nominations.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I would pop up on TV.
So you're doing clubs at 15?
Doing clubs and TV and stuff.
Yeah.
And then went so off the rails and was like kicked out of my house. And so
So how did that go down?
That was no good. Yeah.
15?
Yeah.
That's when you ran off to England?
No, I moved in with some old boyfriend and
in Canada.
Yeah.
And you just were just doing blow every day?
No, that's when I sort of, so like 16, 17, I stopped doing blow and I was just doing all the other ones, all the other things. And then, I was kind of couch surfing for a while and then
lost.
So lost. And then finally when I started doing comedy again at like 20, after a couple of years just being too messed up to do it, I went to rehab and then I...
At 20?
Yeah, 19.
Where?
In Toronto.
Oh, all right.
I put myself there.
Like an inpatient?
No, it was a day program, but I did it for 9 months, Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And did it work?
I think it did in a way. It was harm reduction, so it wasn't abstinence. And I don't think I would have gone if it was... A live-in thing, you know? But it felt manageable, and I was so broke, and I knew that they would give you one free packet of instant noodles and one packet of oatmeal, and that you'd get. And I wanted to reconnect with my parents too.
So how long were you out of the house? How long did that? How? What was the drama in kicking you out of the house?
I don't know. I mean, if you ask them, I'm sure they would have their experience of it must have been very painful and different. But mine was that. I think they were really angry at being lied to. And I think there was an ultimatum of like, you can go to work with turtles in South America. We'll pay for you to do that.
And that's abstract.
Very abstract and specific. And I was like, oh, well, but I have a comedy career and I don't want to do that. And
where did that come from? The turtles?
I don't know. I don't know. But
it's awesome.
Yeah.
They must have read about some program for drug addicts.
Completely.
That involved working with turtles.
I know. And I was like, I don't want to meet these turtles.
They heard it on a radio show or something. That seems like a good thing for May.
I've never expressed any interest in turtles. Yeah.
So it got ugly. Because, like, you know, you don't present now as somebody that would be like some sort of total fuck up.
Well, this is the weird thing is like, I don't think I ever even really raised my voice. Like I was always this person. I just was like lying all the time and high all the time. But I was never mean, I think. Or
yeah. Were you stealing?
Yeah. I was stealing and being a real asshole, but just always being like, hello.
Yeah.
That's
a little more intense. Actually. Yeah.
So I think they did Tough Love.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is the best.
Well, it just sent you out into the streets to couch surf and do other drugs for how many years?
We barely spoke for about 2 years, and then we reconnected, and now we're super close. And it feels like we were all just having like a psychotic episode or something in that time. Like we're a lot closer now. And
so the rehab, was it AA driven? I guess it wouldn't be.
No, it was like a youth. Harm reduction day program. And they, you know, we would like cook.
Self-harm reduction kind of thing?
No, like, so harm reductions just means like a model that's not forced, sort of abstinent. Okay. Like you'd come in the morning and they'd go, what drugs did you do last night? And it was the first experience I'd had where I could say and no one would be mad at me.
Yeah.
And they would really meet you where you were at and be like, okay, well, that's less than you did the night before, so that's good. Or why do you think you did that? And having adults be kind of... not mad.
Yeah.
It was really good.
And the other kids in the program, did you make any long-term friendships or just more drug buddies?
I'm in touch with one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, at first it was just like
Yeah, what do you got?
Yeah, at 3 p.m. every day we'd go and, yeah, egg each other on. But
try to do less than you did yesterday?
Exactly. Yeah, we played a lot of poker. And,
yeah, yeah.
But they were really, it was very eye-opening. I had a lot of shame about, like, my privilege because these kids had come from really tough backgrounds. So yeah. I was just like, what is my problem? Like,
I know. It's weird when you sort of have it and you can't really track it
yeah.
to environmental problems.
I mean, even in 12-step meetings, sometimes you're like listening to other
never
people's
got that
story. Yeah, and you're just like, oh, sorry, everyone.
But then if you really think, though, like I have that experience, too, when I would go to meetings, like, you know, whatever your bottom is or however close you got to it. I mean, I think some people are just built for low bottoms. Mm. But I mean, it is relative to how much you compromised who you were for the drugs.
Right.
And what danger did you get into?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And not everybody's cut out for the full ride to the bottom.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's all relative.
Yeah.
And you're just lucky if you're not a low bottom person.
Did you hit a bottom or?
Yeah, it just got scary. And, you know, I was, and I'd gone in and out for years.
Mm-hmm.
For years. I mean, the first time I got sober was in 1988.
Oh,
after I coked myself into psychosis at the Comedy Store.
Whoa.
I was a doorman. I was 22. And I drove back to Albuquerque and I went inpatient for a month. And then I'd stay sober for like a year and a half here, 12 months there. But, you know, I'm going to have, I guess, 25 years this year.
Congrats. That's
but that's starting in 88. So I was in and out. It took me a long time to get it.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time I really got it, I had surrendered to a type of self-hatred and resignation around never being successful or never manifest. You know, and I was married to a woman that it was not correct.
Yeah.
And I was hiding the drug addiction. It was like...
Yeah.
So it was, it was a bottom, but I, you know, and there were moments during that because I was married, I had to go do it on the road.
Yeah.
So when you're kind of like doing that, where you're looking forward to like getting out of town in 2 weeks, you're really going to hit it pretty hard and you're going to be with weirdos.
I know.
You know, there might be guns around and people are going to rob you. It's just, I feel like when you use drugs that you exponentially, the possibility of dying somehow.
Yes.
Car, gun, weird people, whatever, drugs. It's just gross.
Oh, the situations you get yourself in. And and then you have so many bottoms that don't end up being bottoms. Like the.
Sure. Because you take a break.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I guess I'm okay.
That coke-induced psychosis thing. Like I had like maybe a 9-hour kind of auditory hallucination.
Yes.
Have you had that? And
I would have auditory hallucinations a lot.
Yes.
But sadly, it's always sounded like a crowd of people.
I know what you mean. Yes.
And you're just kind of like, what are they talking about?
Yeah. And coming out of that 9 hours and realizing that it was all not there, because I really thought I had heard all kinds of stuff. And then, and then you think, the next day you're doing it again.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
The losing the mind thing. But also I got very sort of like, you know, kind of paranoid. Like I thought I understood mystical things.
Oh, right.
Which is a fucking nightmare.
Or like ascribing mystical importance to like coincidences and
that's
things.
That's right, right.
Yes.
You did that too?
Yes.
That's totally the cocaine psychosis.
Yes.
Man, it took me a long time to shake that totally.
Mm.
Because once you put those systems in place.
Yeah.
Where once you ascribe mystical importance to coincidences, I mean, your brain kind of believes it.
I know. And then we're in LA where everybody feels that there's like so many hippies around being like,
Yeah, it's all connected. Well, I was at the Comedy Store thinking I was part of some like weird, evil, mystical, you know, like it was big too. It was end of the world stuff and it all had to do with Hollywood and some of it was about, you know, the devil and the comedy. So, so I had big ideas, man. And I was hanging out with Kennison, who was not a great mentor.
Right.
So if you're going to start thinking evil shit, he's going to be the guy that's going to feed it.
I was dating a much older guy who was convinced that the book, The Neverending Story, was like the story of his life and like that everything.
Is the guy you did coke with?
Yes.
Okay.
And I was like totally on board with it and that something was fucked up was going on with this book. And
right.
We,
and you guys knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. That's the vibe. It took me a long time because I would come back to LA after after I would clean up and then I come back and I'd get to the Comedy Store and it was still had that haunted zone.
Yes. Yeah. I think I got banned from Second City for 2 years.
Yeah.
And that was helpful. And then it's what you were saying though about just, I mean, you were looking for your day-to-day life. You weren't happy. So you were looking forward to getting away from it. And it's only pretty recently that I'm like really pumped about my home life.
Yeah.
Like, and
yeah. Well, it's some bigger version of that cigarette at the end of the day.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a bigger version of that.
Yeah.
And, when I finally got sober for real and I came back to LA, you know, it did take a while for me just to realize like, this is just a place, dude.
Right.
You know, like, and I always quote this Tom McGuane quote where he says, the mind is not a boomerang. If you throw it too far, it won't come back.
Oh, that's a great quote.
Right?
Yeah.
And like, I realized, like, I had to reel it in. I had to decide to shut that shit down.
Yeah.
Because I have that mystical thing where, mm-hmm. like, I'll be like, come on, why did this just happen?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't, there's nothing wrong with it a little bit.
Yeah. But
like, you know, things happen for a reason or however you want to frame it. But if you're sort of like, this is a sign.
Yeah.
And fuck.
That's a red flag. And yeah.
I do it a little though.
I do too.
But then I got to stop it. I got to be like, no.
And I have to be super vigilant about like not glamorizing or not. I mean, all through my 20s, I thought suffering was so crucial to the creative process. And that, even though you know that that's not true, it's so hard to get out of that way of
thinking. I never thought I talk about that a lot where I never felt like I was encouraging my mental suffering for my art.
Mm.
I did understand that tormented people do creative shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, comics are sad and whatever, the struggle and all that. But like, I wasn't necessarily aspiring to that. It was just who I am.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I talked to my buddy Sam even last night where I'm like, I have this anxiety and I'm tired of it. And he's like, yeah, but it's sort of what fuels you. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not great.
Yeah. And I think that's a myth a little bit because you don't know how productive you'd be without it.
Yeah, I wonder.
Yeah, maybe.
I kind of have built a system and I do okay.
Yeah, that's true.
I know that people, you know, seem to do a lot more things than me. Like, I don't even understand how people like, you know, when you just see people that are like, you have 90 different things going on.
Yeah.
And they just seem to be showing up for all that. It's like, and then these people that have to, you know, manage their social media presence every day and stuff like.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time not doing work and I like it, but I'm very busy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, for me, it's like if I got to cook something or go to the supermarket or go pick up a thing.
That's a full day. Like,
totally.
In between like doing my laundry.
Right.
Yeah. Feeding myself.
Sure.
Taking a shower every day.
Yeah.
It's bedtime.
Yeah. And getting coffee and then, you know, doing the three emails and then like.
Yeah.
But that's our job, I guess.
Yeah.
Like I say that on stage. I talk about how, like, you know, I shop at Whole Foods, but sometimes there's two other supermarkets I go to, and sometimes I'll go to all three in one day. And then I say, like, I don't know what you think comics do during the day.
Yeah,
But that's what I'm doing.
I'm slammed right now because I'm show running a show, and it's the first time I've been in an office Monday to Friday since my early 20s, and it's. Oh man, I I'm supposed to be a good leader, and I'm like staring at the clock and everyone can feel it. Yeah.
I get exhausted.
It's exhausting for some reason.
Just to be in an office right away. Like when I had a writer's room, I'm like, I gotta sleep.
Yeah.
What show are you running?
It's a new show I'm doing for Netflix Canada. It's a thriller about two teenage girls who get sent to like a troubled teen school in the woods.
Did you create it?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And then it's a sort of cult thriller. Yeah.
Oh, so there you go. You're kind of exercising demons.
Always. Yeah. I gotta move on. Stop processing my teens.
But this at least seems like a fictional landscape because in the show that I watched, what was that called?
Feel Good.
Feel Good.
Yeah.
I mean, that was you being you.
Yeah, it was super.
Some version.
Yes.
Because I could feel it because I did that with Marin where it's almost too personal for people to have distance from.
Yeah.
Like they watch it and you're like, this isn't made up.
I know. I know. And people feel like they know you and you're like, well, you kind of do,
you
I guess.
You kind of do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a weird way to do a show. But my creativity is like that, too. It's very hard for me to imagine some, you know, fictional landscape where I can create.
Even coming up with a fictional job for a character I'm going to play, I'm like, I don't really know how to do any other job. Yeah. And write it with, you know.
Well, I think there's something about people in, but your struggle was actually more specific. But when you are, for one reason or another, trying to just find yourself and hold on to it, I mean, that's sort of all you can do.
Yeah.
Right? Because I, you know, with comedy, it was always this journey. It wasn't like I didn't want to be an entertainer. I felt like I was pursuing some sort of, you know, truth or about myself or about being seen or about having at least boundaries where I could see that, like, I'm me.
Yes.
And that.
That's such a good way to put it.
Right? Yeah. Like, this is my territory. I'm going to find myself here.
Yeah.
And you guys have to sit through it.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, being seen maybe because, you want to be understood. And yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But for you, the struggle was more physical.
I didn't realize, but yeah, I think it really was. Yeah. And yeah, I don't know if for you, like, I hadn't really acted before and then playing myself.
Yep.
And then after that, I thought, oh, okay, I could
now.
But it definitely was, I didn't understand about acting.
No, you
at
had
all.
To. Yeah, I didn't. I'd done a few little things.
Yeah.
But going into that show that not a lot of people saw, but I did four seasons of it, I knew from other comics doing those things that I wasn't going to be good for maybe the first season.
Yeah.
All of it.
Yes.
And I'm just going to have to suck that up.
Oh, it's terrifying.
Yeah, but you do learn how to be on a set because there's so many other things other than just showing up and being present for the acting.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, you got to be a person that sort of like is able to not deal with the not notice the cameras, you know, just find the focus, and you learn how to do that.
Yeah, and I thought it was just about arranging my face in the emotion, and like I was like, I got to make my face look really sad, and then someone was like, just feel sad, and your face will naturally do it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh right, yeah, right. I guess, yeah.
I have to arrange my face. Oddly, that's a good instinct because Jeff Daniels told me that you have to learn how to work your face because all of film acting is the face. I never thought about it.
Yeah.
But when you look at movies, it's almost
it's just face.
It is kind of.
Yeah. And sometimes you think, oh man, this is skin deep right now. This scene, I'm not feeling it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is going to look terrible.
Yeah.
And you watch it and you're like, that's the best scene. And I wasn't feeling anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I just pulled it off.
Yeah.
Pulled him again. Yeah. I breathe through my mouth. So I'm always nervous. My mouth is going to be hanging open.
But
so
that's a real style. You notice some actors always have their mouths open.
Oh, really?
Kind of,
oh, good.
It kind of works.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay. I'll lean into it.
Yeah, lean into it. Mouth wide open. Yeah.
Yeah. Just gasping for air.
Yeah.
So wait. So when you moved to England, you were 20?
Yeah, 21.
21, yeah. And you were headlining already?
I managed to skip over kind of open mics because I already had stuff from Canada.
Right.
So I wasn't headlining, but...
Featuring? Strong feature?
Yeah. And then doing the clubs. And then also there's such a culture of like the Edinburgh Fringe Festival there and more theatrical stuff. And
I don't know how you did it. Like I make myself crazy about cultural differences, but it's different. It's definitely different doing comedy there than it is here.
It's so different.
And the Fringe thing, like, you know, just sort of, you know, package your comedy into a kind of, you know, mushy theme.
Yeah.
For an hour. Like, a lot of that stuff is a stretch, but I did a couple one-person shows, and like,
It is, by the end of the month, you're super tight. I mean, to do an hour every night like that for random Scottish audiences is...
But did you always think thematically? I mean, because you do bits and you were doing short sets in Britain, right? Like 15-20s?
Yeah. And then...
Just stand-up, but then you kind of sort of... Was it always autobiographical after a certain point?
Sort of. My first couple of hours in Edinburgh were just a mishmash of like, like sort of musical comedy and bits.
Oh,
and
really?
Just like a really... Some yeah.
You do some singing?
Oh man, I'm doing like earnest. Like I'm putting out an album this year of the most mediocre emotional songs.
Really?
Do
you play guitar? Or
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So.
But back then I was doing like changing the lyrics to existing songs, like the
parodies,
the lowest form of comedy.
Yeah. Of course.
But
wow.
Yeah, and then I think having. Watching tons of shows up there, I was like, okay, people have this kind of theatrical arc to their hour,
and then. Kind of put it together that way.
Put the guitar
so
away,
doing, and... but you put together your sets with a theme or with at least an arc.
The last the hours. Few hours, yeah.
Yeah, because this one's that way. Sap is.
Yeah, vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the trick is the callback. I mean, if you don't have a theatrical arc. If you got a couple callbacks,
that's it.
It serves the same purpose.
It tricks people into feeling like they've seen something really.
It's amazing how often it tricks them.
Yeah,
they're very excited about callbacks. Mm-hmm. But wait, tell me about this this Ernest album that you.
Well, I only. I'm embarrassed by it, and so I don't know how I'm ever going to promote it. I might just put it out and
you have a label, or are you quietly, just going to do it yourself?
No, I got a label. It's fucked. And I, I've always played music and stuff and done, sad Elliott Smith covers and stuff.
Sure.
And then recently I don't know, when I moved to LA, I knew more musicians than comics out here, and so I did an album.
Wow.
It's if a musician listens to it, I think they'll be like, this is very mediocre, but I think hopefully people who like me will get that it's like an extension of
Well, I think the audience you have, if you don't somehow upset them, is very supportive and will be willing.
They're super, and they like Ernest.
Totally.
So I think they'll be open to it.
It's surprising they tolerate funny.
I know. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But because you play music at Largo and stuff.
I do.
Too. Yeah, so I usually do a song in the Largo shows.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, like with a musical guest, I'll do like a cover or something.
Like I did.
Do you feel embarrassed about it?
Of course.
Okay, good. I'm glad, because I really do, but I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it took me a long time to like be comfortable singing in public. And like I don't really know how to write songs per se.
Yeah.
The band I use at Largo, we just do covers, but it's just for me to work that muscle and feel comfortable about it.
Man, I so relate, and it feels like when you started doing stand-up, like I get so nervous to sing.
Oh,
my voice shakes. I'm like, what is happening?
Me too. Like, and then, but the benefit of having your fans there is sort of like, are you going to try this?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I'm going to get through this song.
Yeah.
It's a cop out, but fuck it.
Yeah.
I'm not there to put on a professional music show.
I know. And they are so, I mean, Largo is such a joy.
It's very,
they're so warm.
But I wrote one song after Lynn died, and it was like, okay. And I put it out there on my podcast at the end, and I was pretty proud of it, but I just can't. I don't know if I can handle the criticism. Like, I know I'm an okay guitar player, and I know I can rock pretty good, and I can play with feeling.
Yeah.
But like writing songs is a whole other thing. And people are like, I don't like when people come down on my comedy.
I know. And at least with comedy, you have irony, and but when you're saying this is just how I feel, it's so terrifying. And I don't want to be criticized because I love it.
Right.
It's a hobby.
That's why I keep it to myself.
I know. And now I'm going to ruin that for myself. But
maybe it'll turn out okay.
I think maybe it will. I think more than comedy, I understand that music is so subjective that if someone doesn't like it, I'm like, yeah, because some of my best friends, we listen to totally different music.
Sure.
So I can at least be like, all right, yeah.
And also there's like, you take it in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a magical thing, music. But it is, I do love it, and I've never done it professionally.
Yeah.
Because I think I just had a fear.
Same.
And the vulnerability of singing is crazy.
Oh.
Some people can just belt it out and they don't give a shit. Like even when I was watching your show, the TV show, there's a karaoke scene, and I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah.
I can never do karaoke, and people just go up there, and they don't care how they sound.
I know.
It was the most scary thing in the world.
I want to get over that, but I have the same thing. Like, my voice truly shakes, and I do want to push through that, because I used to be like that with comedy. My knees would shake. Like,
I know. What is it, though, like, about... Why is it so scary and embarrassing to do music, to sing?
Maybe some primal, like...
I don't know, man. I think it's still that kind of that weird, like, whatever our sense of self is and the vulnerability of it and the fear of being hurt.
Yes.
Kind of activates.
But I'm on, like, a lifelong journey of undoing
that,
like, trying to be cool in my teens and trying to curate what I'm presenting. Like... Because all the people I love are silly idiots, and I'm really enjoying doing like improv again. I haven't done improv in years, and I'm doing that, and it's like it forces you to be clowny and dumb and not as like and
I'd like to do more of that.
It's super fun.
Yeah, just to be physically, like I'm very hung up, like because I know innately I'm physically funny, but when you do physical comedy, which in my last couple specials I've got at least a couple of bits where I have to kind of choreograph physical comedy and make decisions around beats physically, very and it's It's always kind of interesting. It's like a whole other muscle.
I know. I'm pretty in my head and yeah, just exactly. standing pretty still.
Right.
And, or I know you sit down and stuff
sometimes,
like
that. Sometimes, yeah.
yeah. And so doing improv, I think the being more comfortable with myself physically has let me. Now, if I do improv, I'm playing like women and old men and yeah. little kids. And it's like, I couldn't do that before I had surgery and like. Because now I'm like, well, I know who I am, and I know people are seeing me the way.
The boobs got in the way?
They got in the way, you know? I was like, yeah. I was like, I'm trying so hard just to present how I feel and be seen. You know, why would I undo that by playing an old lady?
Right.
But now I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Sure.
Who gives a shit?
Man. Yeah, because you've arrived in your body.
Yeah.
When did you have that surgery?
Like 2 years ago.
And it was like the best thing in the world?
Oh, man. It was so crazy. I honestly.
But the decision leading up to it was difficult?
Yeah, I thought about it a ton, but then once I made the decision, it was really fast. Like
when did you start being exclusively with women?
I'm not. I've never have been. Yeah,
never.
I always like when I started doing comedy, that was just the prefix to my name was like lesbian comedian. But A, I didn't feel like a girl, and B, I've always dated men.
Yeah,
yeah, still.
Still?
Still, yeah, yeah. I love them. I love the guys. What can I say?
So you're with a dude now?
No, I'm with a woman now.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I don't know. I get why people assume that, but.
I assumed it because it seemed like there was a shift.
Yeah.
But it didn't. They never went away.
They never went away.
They just come sometimes, the guys?
Yeah, they come and go. When I was in England, I dated a guy recently for like 6 months.
So you're not locked into a serious relationship?
I am now, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
For like almost a year now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, with, I'm obsessed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's the first time I've been fully monogamous in a long, long, long time.
You're obsessed, though.
I'm obsessed with my girlfriend. Yeah, and she's a 5-year-old, and that's changing my life. And
yeah,
you know, yeah, it's sick.
Really? And how is that changing your life?
I don't know. It's like you access wells of.
How old is she, your girlfriend?
41.
Uh huh.
Yeah, just wells of like patience and compassion that you didn't know really.
Yeah,
and it keeps you present, man. Like.
Yeah,
I'm awake at 6:30, and by 8:30, I've like written a song and played a game and pretended to be a spider, and I'm like, this is great, this is life.
Yeah. Yeah, and so now, do you find your audience? Have you been criticized ever by the LGBTQ audience about your approach to yourself?
Yeah, for sure. There can be a lot of. Policing within that community for sure. I mean, for the most part, it's been amazing, but
over what?
Like, I remember doing a pride festival and talking about dating men and being booed by a large number of lesbians, like, who were just mad because I wasn't what they wanted me to be.
That's the thing, if you don't represent them,
yeah, and their specific,
right?
I think because there's still there's not a ton of representation, so
that, right?
I think particularly if I'm like kind of cavalier about like labels and things like that. Yeah. And I think that can be frustrating if you're like
fighting for your life.
Yes. I'm fighting so hard for this label. And
yes.
And I'm just like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Then I think that annoys people.
But you made a decision how to represent yourself. You're they, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which feels weird. And I just like, I get that it's weird. I don't know. I like May feels better. And
yeah.
I don't know. None of it really feels. All I know is she feels weird to me. But then again, you know, there's people in my life who say she, and I'm just whatever.
It doesn't. You're not like, excuse me.
No. It bumped a lot more before, and now I'm like, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you just got to correct people, and usually if they're regular people,
they'll
decent
be like,
people,
oh, sorry,
oh,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly. Sorry. Yeah, yeah.
They're not like, what the fuck?
I know. And it's,
I mean, it's not like we're socializing with those people.
No, and it's not, yeah, it's, I'd rather just be understood and hang out with someone than be like, have them be massively on edge. And
yeah, but it is interesting how people want their version represented.
Yeah.
And if they assume things about you and then you don't represent what they think you are.
Totally.
The anger is disproportionate.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no acceptance in that relationship.
But that even happens like, let's say you're doing a Well, like even with Feel Good, for instance, like sure. I had Netflix being like, you know, and for the record, I love Netflix.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
they are great. But they, you know, being like, okay, this is our gay show. And so we got to represent every type of, you know, we should have an asexual character and make sure we're hitting this group and doing this. And it's like,
there's always you don't have to define an asexual character. I know. It's the one not getting laid.
You're like, I'm just telling a story person.
Yeah.
But so, yeah.
But like, they didn't look at, you know, your girlfriend's roommate as asexual, did they?
Well, I'm sure they were like, and how does he identify? Or like, I don't know, he's just a guy.
He's that guy at the beginning of your special.
Yeah. Yes, I love that. Phil Berger is his name.
Yeah.
He's dating Alia Shawkat. And Phil's a very strange and special guy. Yeah.
Yeah, it was an interesting way to open the special. You definitely had a concept. For Sap.
Yeah.
And who directed it?
Abby. Yeah, Abby Jacobson, yeah.
Abby Jacobson directed it. Was that at the Vogue? Where was it?
Yeah, at the Vogue Theater, yeah.
I knew it. It's a nice big wide stage.
You know, you do it twice, and
yeah.
The first audience was just hammered, and they were heckling, and someone in the front row got up, put their coat on halfway through. I was like, where are you going? She was like, oh, I got to get my bus. I was like, what's happening? I'm filming this. Yeah, but it was...
I got to get my bus.
who directed your special?
Stephen Fine Arts did the last one.
Oh, amazing.
And then Lynn Shelton did the two before that. And then Bobcat directed one. Lance Bangs directed one. I've had a few directors.
It's a weird thing, the director... I guess it is whatever you want that relationship to be.
Right. I mean, but you definitely... There was a concept there to have a vibe with all the trees.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it starts at a campfire-ish kind of thing.
Yeah. I've always had an imposter syndrome about this whole job, and especially stand-up.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, starting 20 years ago in green rooms and stuff.
Yeah.
And just feeling, you know, not wanting to be one of the guys. And not,
sure.
So... I think I liked the idea of presenting it almost like a kind of storytelling, fireside, warm thing.
Yeah,
like, is not going to be punchline after punchline after punchline. There's a more relaxed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the way to go. I mean, you know, I mean, it feels like if you want to be, you can be punchline efficient. But, like, you know, it's nice to leave room for that. That thing I beat myself up again about for having that point of view, which I do as well a lot of times, is like, well, are you just not working hard enough?
Yeah.
Why can't you just make the funny?
Yeah.
Like, why do you have to leave that room?
I know. Well, hopefully, but you're building to something, and you're drawing people in. And
no, of course. I think that's true.
But
I still think kind of joke to joke. They're just long, like the jokes. You know, big pieces are a bunch of jokes, and they grow as time goes on because I do most of the writing on stage, right?
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
You do too.
Yeah.
So you're waiting for it.
Yeah.
You're waiting for the weird delivery.
Yeah.
That's the best.
The best, and then the little when laughs are coming in the setup, that's the best.
Where
you're like, yeah.
Or how about when you get one of those little gifts on stage where it comes to you and it kills, and then you try it again and it's not as good. God damn it!
I love working with Abby Jacobson because she's not a stand-up.
Yeah.
She is an. We have a similar taste, and she was just awesome.
Yeah, I liked it. I liked the bookends of the weird story about the guy with the mail.
Yeah, it's a true story. That mailman.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of.
Just bearing all the mail.
Is he a mentally ill guy?
Yeah, must be, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't frame it that way, but now that you mention it, he's probably very unwell.
But then, like, tell me about, like, the, what is it, a parable, an allegory? What was the last thing? How'd you frame it?
Yeah, this, like, Buddhist parable.
It is a real Buddhist parable?
Yeah.
Because, like, now I just want to know when you did the punchline, the reveal of the parable, which made a lot of sense to you, but the audience was just sort of still waiting.
Yeah, which I kind of like. So
But that was a real moment.
It was a real moment for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Cause it,
I like when that happens.
It's pretty self-indulgent, that parable, but I like it. And like, cause I write on stage and I would just telling shit from my head.
Right. But like, I've had those moments where you're like, this is like, everyone's going to
Yeah.
Get this.
And then just dead silence.
Nothing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or you're like, huh, there's not going to be a dry eye in the house. And everyone's like, yeah.
Not a laugh or a tear.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of confusion.
But good to leave it in as your closer, even though it didn't land, you know?
I've made, well, you kind of pulled, it was, so that was real.
Yeah.
You had to, did it not land both shows?
It never landed, but I did enjoy that. It maybe landed a little bit more in smaller rooms, but I kind of liked that.
I make these decisions like I throughout my entire career I've made horrendous wardrobe decisions, horrendous,
oh my God, yeah,
over and over again for years.
What do you mean, just for your specials and stuff?
Totally. Any TV appearance.
I would never have thought that. I think you always look great.
Well, that's nice. I appreciate that. But I on End Times Fun, that vest and that collarless shirt.
Yeah.
The fuck was that? I never wore them again. Never wore them again.
Yeah.
And I look at that vest, I'm like, dude. Like, but in the moment, I'm like, this is great.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the fuck?
I did that. I did a half hour special. Yeah. I tried a French tuck with my shirt, like tucking the front in. I've never done that before or after, and it looked so bad, and no one told me.
Why do we do it? Like, why on that day?
I know.
Why go back? But then I'm like, I'm just going to wear my old flannel shirt.
Yeah.
And I did that for one of the specials, and it looked terrible.
Really?
It was just this old shitty, L.L. Bean flannel.
Yeah.
That I wore all the time. It's too big. It looked like I didn't even prepare or dress for my fucking special.
I think people like that, though.
I guess.
Yeah.
But the last one, I had a wardrobe person make some suggestions, and it looked pretty good. Yeah. I didn't love my hair in retrospect.
I just do black or white t-shirts now, mainly.
I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But I was looking at the trees that you had all the plants.
Yeah.
The forest, and it was good. I think any way you slice it, it's going to age pretty well.
Well,
the woods, the stump. I don't know about the stump.
I know. It was the first time I'd been involved in a budget, and I was like, yeah, trees. And then it was the night of the taping, and I was like, oh, this looks pretty sick.
Yeah.
And then I said to the Netflix executive, so what do you think? I was about to go on stage, and she goes, yeah, it looks great. It's so funny. It's the second special we've had recently that we taped with a forest on stage. Hannah Gadsby did the same thing. I was what?
My God damn.
And then
it.
She showed me the picture and I was like, oh, I can't change it now. But I was like,
of course,
it's Hannah Gadsby too. Why? I'm compared to Hannah so much, even though I think we have totally different styles.
Yeah. And there you were with the trees.
The last time I was at Just for Laughs, there's some comic who I was with a friend and I'd never met this guy. He's a comic I like. And he was like, well, you probably got to go to Hannah Gadsby's party tonight or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, but I haven't been invited, but I don't know.
How do you interpret that?
I think it's...
do you think that, is that the same as going, because, you know, saying something like, well, you're one of them, so.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, I get that. But is he just, maybe he feels, it could be he was felt outside of it. And
That must be partly where.
Yeah, because it couldn't have been.
Subconsciously, it comes from. That
sure,
he's
sure.
Feeling, yeah, yeah.
You have a community and a group.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm just another idiot comic.
Yeah.
It must be hard to interpret that kind of stuff. Oh, but I'll tell you the story of my Comedy Central Presents.
Oh, yeah.
Where we were given. I did two of those many years apart, and they let you choose your own background, your own set.
Okay.
Right. So the first one, you know, which was like the first Comedy Central Presents, it was the same one that Hedberg did that made him like forever famous.
Yeah.
That grouping, it was shot here.
The same year?
Yeah, yeah. It was the same bunch of tapings.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but mine didn't surface.
Right.
But but I decided for some reason that because of the way I felt about myself, I wanted a circus sideshow banner.
Oh, my God. So flamboyant, dude. Just like this wild.
Well, it was kind of subtle, but it was that.
A circus.
Just like freaks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm like, well, that's like, it, metaphorically, it makes sense to me. But to anybody looking at it, sort of like, what's with the
circus? With this?
Yeah. So that was one bad decision. The other decision, where I did a Comedy Central Presents years later and I was doing a lot of political material, was like, you know, I want to feel like I'm, you know, fighting the good fight.
Okay.
So I chose for the background to be a picture of a herd of sheep.
Oh my God.
Walking the other way. right? A bunch of sheep walking away. Like, I'm facing you, and they're walking the other way behind me. And then I put a fucking stuffed sheep on stage.
Oh, my God.
To represent, like, you know,
just to really hammer it home.
I'm the one that's, like, you know, going the other way.
Yeah, you guys are sheep.
Yeah, yeah. And it just, it doesn't read at all. It's just sort of like, why is there a stuffed sheep? And why is his head right in line with a bunch of sheep asses?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
But, man, when I thought of it, I'm like, fuck, this is it. This is it, dude.
Yeah.
Fuck. I don't know, man. I guess.
I know. I guess neutral is sort of the way to go. I was leaning heavily into the Canadian thing. Yeah.
The last one, Bleak to Dark, I thought that looked good.
Looked really good.
I just had a sense of, like, you know, grayness and clouds that I found evocative. And then the guy kind of did that background thing and it kind of all came together.
Yeah.
And the outfit worked.
Yeah.
The hair looked a little old man hippie hair, but
I'm not really a visually minded person. Like, are you, like, even with my posters or whatever, I just gotta get
someone to do it.
Yeah. You gotta, yeah.
I mean, that's why you gotta, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes with that stuff. And,
same.
And as you get older, you just sort of like, oh, I like that guy's art.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll do a thing for me.
Yeah.
That's the way you do it.
Yeah.
Good talking to you, mate.
Oh, man, this was so nice. Yeah. What, I'm really honored, honestly, to be here. Yeah,
well, that's nice. I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, me too.
See? There you go. That was a fine talk. You can check out May's specials in the series Feel Good on Netflix, as well as their podcast, Handsome, and Audible series Benefits with Friends. Hang out for a minute, people. Hey, if you want some classic WTF this week, over on the Full Marin, we posted the original edit of my trip to the Creation Museum in Kentucky, as well as my stand-up bit that came from that visit.
So you move past Adam, and just to the left of Adam, a single white penguin.
Doesn't matter, that's not the right climate. It's Eden, don't judge, as a penguin.
And then I realized this was just a mental palate cleanser for what's about to happen. Because you said, okay, penguin, you turn the corner, T-Rex! Eating a pineapple! And my only thought at that moment was like, a pineapple? That doesn't make sense. And I'm like, oh no, they got me!
To sign up for the Full Marin so you can get all our weekly bonus episodes, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. Next week, we've got three episodes again. Actor Ben Mendelsohn on Monday, then a special episode on Wednesday featuring talks with this year's Oscar nominees. And then comedian Rory Scovel is back on Thursday. Plus, we'll have more Oscar talk over on the Full Marin next Tuesday and Friday. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some nice guitar. Simple. Simple. And it's a song, if you know it.
Boomer Lives, Monkey and LaFonda, Cat Angels Everywhere. That song is for all the Jersey girls.